Welcome to Bankless. This is Ryan Sean Adams. I've got a big question going into today's episode. I'm sure it's a question on your mind as well. We had this insane sell-off earlier this week, and it feels like everyone in crypto is just caught licking their wounds and wondering. They've got a question on their mind. Is the bull market over? We have a guest today, Tom Lee, who says it's not over, not by a long shot. We'll get to that conversation in just a minute. But first, I want to shout out our friends over at Matcha. During crazy weeks of volatility like this, I'm really thankful for Matcha. They are the OG decentralized exchange aggregator. They'll give you the best price on any trade size, especially the big ones. One-time token allocation means your tokens are never at risk of smart contract exploit. It's also incredibly user-friendly. If you want to get serious about your DEX trades, Matcha is what I use. It's what David uses. You can go to matcha.xyz to get started. Okay, so back to today's conversation with Tom. My goal in today's episode was just to get a few basic questions answered. They're basic questions, but there's a lot of nuance to them, as you'll hear in today's episode. First, I wanted to know, why exactly did markets get thumped so hard on Monday? Is there a method to this madness? And is there more pain to come? Next, the question on my mind is, of course, is the bull market over? This word recession, is that actually going to come to pass? Are we going to have to pause the bull market and get over some things first? What are the bear and bull cases at this point in time? And lastly, what are Tom's predictions for price with respect to crypto? He's been a longtime crypto bull on CNBC. I saw him as early as 2017 talking about crypto. So he's seen a pivot in Wall Street appetite here recently. And that's been a fantastic pivot, a positive pivot. What's next? Thanks to Kraken for making this episode possible. You can go from fiat to crypto in seconds, create a Kraken account so you can be ready for the next leg of this bull market whenever it happens. Let's go hear from them now.
If you want a crypto trading experience backed by world-class security and award-winning support teams, then head over to Kraken, one of the longest-standing and most secure crypto platforms in the world. Kraken is on a journey to build a more accessible, inclusive, and fair financial system, making it simple and secure for everyone, everywhere, to trade crypto. Kraken's intuitive trading tools are designed to grow with you, empowering you to make your first or your 100th trade in just a few clicks. And there's an award-winning client support team available 24/7 to help you along the way, along with a whole range of educational guides, articles, and videos. With products and features like Kraken Pro and Kraken NFT Marketplace and a seamless app to bring it all together, it's really the perfect place to get your complete crypto experience. So check out the simple, secure, and powerful way for everyone to trade crypto, whether you're a complete beginner or a seasoned pro. Go to kraken.com/bankless to see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. The Obol Collective is up and running and is maybe one of the most important collectives that you've never heard of. Obol is bringing distributed validators, or DVs, to the Ethereum staking stack. Distributed validators allow multiple parties of people running multiple nodes to create a single virtual Ethereum validator. Together, this makes participating in Ethereum consensus more accessible, more affordable, and more inclusive. It is a strict improvement to the Ethereum staking tech stack. With collaboration from Lido, EtherFi, EigenLayer, and 50 other entities, and thousands of individuals, the Obol Collective is working to scale and decentralize Ethereum using DVs. And now you can get involved. Introducing the Obol Contributions Program. Visit obol.org/bankless to stake on DVs, either through a partner staking protocol or at home. Earn access to future governance and ownership in Obol while contributing to retroactive funding for projects that are actively decentralizing Ethereum. This is your opportunity to secure inclusion in one of the most important projects working to scale Ethereum's foundation for future growth. Visit obol.org/bankless to get started. That's obol.org/bankless.
The Uniswap extension is here.
The self-custody wallet, created by the most trusted team in DeFi, Uniswap Labs, designed to make swapping feel effortless. This extension lives in your browser's sidebar, letting you swap, sign transactions, and send or receive crypto without ever losing your place on the internet. Plus, with human-readable transaction messages, you'll always know exactly what you're signing. Navigate a multi-chain world effortlessly with support for 11 chains like Ethereum Mainnet, Base, Arbitrum, and Optimism. No more chain switching or token importing. All your assets are right where you need them to be. The Uniswap extension is designed to level up your swapping experience with other Uniswap Labs products as well. Easily onboard to the extension using the Uniswap mobile wallet to begin managing your assets across platforms and take advantage of smooth, seamless synergies with the Uniswap web app. So go and download the Uniswap extension today by clicking the link in the show notes. Just another way Uniswap is helping you swap smarter.
Bankless Nation, I'm very excited to introduce you to Tom Lee. He is the head of research at Fundstrat. He's also a CNBC contributor, and that's actually where I saw Tom first. I remember it was way back in 2017, before Bitcoin and crypto were cool on Wall Street. No ETFs back then. And I remember Tom being contrarian bullish on crypto way back then. I think maybe some of the anchors thought he was a little crazy. My have opinions changed in 2024. Tom, welcome to Bankless.
Thank you.
Hey, we're going to get to crypto in just a minute. I know you have thoughts and have had longstanding thoughts on crypto, but first, we just have to talk about this, the downturn. I mean, some people are calling this actually Black Monday. I don't know if it warrants that title, but the market events popped on my radar when I saw on Sunday, just this last Sunday, Ethereum was trading down like 25%. Bitcoin's like down 15%. Anyway, can you tell us what happened earlier this week? What is the event on Sunday and into Monday?
Well, Ryan, that's a great question. I think that we'll probably never know the true reasons, but I would say the things that are high on the suspect list are two things that happened starting last week. One was, I think, sort of the most immediate trigger was the Friday jobs report, which was the employment report for the U.S. for the month of July. And that showed a pronounced weakening of hirings. You know, there were only 114,000 jobs added. That was really one of the first big misses since the start of the pandemic. And I think it really really fueled fears for investors that two things were underway. One was there's this rule called the SOM rule that Claudia Sahm wrote, which is if unemployment picks up 50 basis points, you're already in a recession. And that report showed unemployment had picked up 50.5% from the lows. And the second was that the Federal Reserve had a chance to cut rates just 2 days earlier that they didn't. So now the market sort of panicked because they're like, well, the Fed can't really do anything until September. And it put downside pressure on markets. That was, I think, the first trigger. The second trigger, which might actually have a trigger to the trigger, but the second trigger was that same week, the Bank of Japan raised their overnight rates by 15 basis points. It really was slightly positive already, but it went to 0.25%, which for Japan's the highest overnight rates since the financial crisis. And that triggered what looked like to be a reversal of a lot of what they call carry trades, because the yen weakened further. I'm sorry, the yen started to rally. Yen had been weak, but it had been rallying. And that was making the carry trade, which is you borrow yen and then you buy other currencies, look unattractive. The only reason I'm not sure if these are the triggers is, you know, you never know. And I know some of my colleagues at Fundstrat have actually pointed out that the intervention, you know, there could have also been intervention by the Bank of Japan on currencies because that started on July 12th. That's really when the yen began to weaken. To strengthen. I'm getting these conversions mixed up. And the reason is that at 160 conversion, that sort of offsets the benefits of weaker currency on exports versus the inflationary pressures. And so, you know, it was really on that date that the yen started to rally. So sorry for the long explanation. We really won't know, but there was a lot of panic and deleveraging that took place.
Okay, a lot of panic on the back of recession fears due to unemployment numbers on Friday, and then this yen carry trade, which people are talking about. There's also talk about maybe the conflict in the Middle East and something heating up there that's kind of unknown. Kamala Harris White House, sort of the market may be reacting to that and saying, well, like maybe it's not as favorable if the Democrats win the White House again. AI just being incredibly frothy this year, could it have been one of those things as well?
Yeah, I mean, those are all like valid contributing factors too. Yeah. And as you know, like when it comes to war, markets don't like the buildup, you know, so they always say you sell the buildup, you buy the invasion. So we'll have an idea of how markets really feel once the retaliation starts.
Okay, so can I get some context on how bad this actually was? I saw this chart of the VIX, right? And like you see these lines going up on the VIX in 2008, it goes crazy, and then like COVID 2020, and then this event on Sunday and into Monday, and it looks spiky. And of course, like 2008 was world changing, and as was COVID. And this had a similar kind of like effect on the market. And indeed, I haven't seen a down day on crypto on a weekend of like 20% plus in quite a long time. And crypto kind of reverberates some of this as well. But like, how bad was this? And what's the likelihood that we get some aftershocks, after booms, that this continues?
I mean, it was pretty bad. I think you kind of highlighted one of the best measures for it, which is... the VIX, the spot index, and it hit 60. And, you know, again, it's not clear why the VIX hit that level. You know, there's many reasons it spikes. I mean, it's basically the expected volatility in markets, and it did soar. Is it because the carry trade was already short vol, so that's why they had to cover, and that's why it spiked? Or is it the longs were trapped over the last few days, especially over the weekend, and one way to protect is to go... is through the VIX, is through trading volatility, or is it just the market was so uncertain that that's what happened? Because, you know, that's what happens in panics. In fact, the skewness of the puts versus calls actually went to minus 25. And, you know, again, that is a pretty rare reading. It happens usually near the end of a panic. So I think there was definitely a lot of panic. A lot of margin calls, as you can imagine. So I think margin clerks were really busy yesterday. And I think a lot of that dust is settling today. But it does sound like a lot of it was retail liquidations. I think high net worth and institutions were actually buying yesterday.
Okay. Do you think there's anything to maybe uncover at some point in time? Do you think any like major funds got sort of wiped out? I mean, we were watching this in crypto, and Jump Crypto was just sell on a lot of their crypto assets. You know, that's not definitive proof of what's going on, but like obviously when this sort of cascading high volatility days happen in crypto to the downside, people get liquidated, and it can get pretty ugly out there. Do you think some of that will we'll see evidence for that in the days and weeks to come?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. The jump, which happened over the weekend, was really stood out. And as you know, short volatility was a crowded trade, so anyone being caught short volatility on a spike to 60, I mean, that is deadly. Last year, on a smaller spike in volatility, especially across rates, had already triggered the failure of a very large multi-billion-dollar hedge fund in the U.S. And I don't really want to name that fund, but it, you know, viewers can sort of look back. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there's a couple of failures, and it'll be revealed in coming days.
Okay, well, maybe there's a binary here. It's either over, that was sort of a Sunday blip, and then we sort of resume the bull market that we've been in, or it's not over, and there are worse things to come, and like more dips and more volatility, etc. What's maybe the case for each, and where do you fall on that argument?
I mean, we're in the camp that this was a growth scare. And, you know, if the trigger was either the jobs report Friday or even this carry trade unwind, those are temporary effects anyways for markets. You know, to be concerned, it's a larger effect. One has to believe that a recession is already starting, you know, so that the Fed can't act to contain the ripple effects, or that financial conditions tightened in a way that require more intervention, and that essentially dilutes the ability for stocks to recover. And as you know, yesterday, and I think a lot of people talked about it, the carnage was primarily in the equity markets. Credit was actually really well behaved, whether you looked at triple C or high yield or spreads or bond volatility. You know, there's a VIX for the for long bonds, VXTLT, all of those were relatively behaved. So this really did look a lot like an equity panic. And there is a rule of thumb that we used to use at JP Morgan, which is that, bonds lead stocks. So when stocks diverge like this and there's panic, it shows you people were trying to get liquidity. They weren't necessarily responding to something had changed. And so if the selling frenzy is over, the recovery should be pretty sharp for risk assets, knowing, of course, that we're in August.
Right, exactly. So let's say it was a growth scare, then what's kind of your base case assumption? Does it take a while to heal from this? Do we sort of resume the same trajectory that we've been on? Do things change a little bit?
Well, there's kind of a scarcity or paucity of labor-related data in the next month, because you don't get another real jobs report until August, first week of September for the August jobs report. So that's a month away. But as you know, yesterday, the ISM services had an employment component, and that actually showed a recovery. And on Friday, a lot of economists, including our own team, pointed out that there were so many things that made it look like Hurricane Beryl probably affected the jobs report for July. Texas is vulnerable to heat already because when it's hot, you have to slow down a lot of activity. And in Texas, jobless claims rose 20,000 in the month. And there was almost a record number of people either employed and not working due to heat or turned to part-time because of weather for both cases. And it was like 1 million in one category and 400,000 other. And both were like Six Sigma changes in for that reported category in the household survey. So I don't know. I mean, the only thing is it's incongruent, because jobless claims aren't really consistent with a huge downturn in the labor market. And a lot of it is Texas, the jump in claims, because ex-Texas jobless claims have actually for the last four weeks been pretty flat. And 1 million people lost power in Texas for 2 weeks. So you could see the knock-on effects on the economy from that. So I would say I think it's a growth scare.
Okay, so you think it's a growth scare, and your eyes are really on this indicator of the next jobs report that happens in September. And this should tell us whether we are creeping closer to, using the R word, recession, or whether we've been in one, or whether we're resume the growth trajectory. And let's say jobs reports, numbers coming good.
I want to make something clear, interestingly. So, if you look at the SOM rule,
yeah,
which is that 50 basis point rise in unemployment rate, since 19, here, I'm going to pull it up here. Do you know that since 1949, that rule's been triggered 12 times, okay? And 10 of the 12 times, you are already one quarter or two quarters into a recession. Hmm. Two times a recession was delayed. One was 1959, and the second time is it was triggered in July 2003. And the next recession wasn't until 2007. So the SOM rule, the reason, and Claudia SOM herself has disavowed it actually publicly in many appearances in the last 4 days, is that you'd already be in a recession. She made this rule because she wanted a simplified way to be ahead of the NBER. And she's basically saying it's not working because COVID kind of screwed up a lot of the metrics. So unless we're already in a recession, it's a bad signal. And actually, some weird math, but if you look at forward stock returns from the time the SOM rule's triggered since the Greenspan era, the 3-month gain is 8% for the S&P. So you'd already be in a recession, if it's triggered. So it's actually been a terrible tactical timing tool for stocks.
Okay, so let's say we're not in a recession, jobs numbers come in reasonably strong in September, then what happens?
Well, the Fed starts cutting, but the Fed, I think, again, Sorry, I'm speaking sort of propositionally because I don't know the Fed. Nobody knows what the Fed's going to do. So I think if we're talking about September, I'm just sort of being theoretical.
Sure.
But I think that they've committed to cutting. And the labor market has softened. It's just that it's not recessionary. So they would be compelled to take action. And so it's either 25 or 50. But one variation now of the Fed's reaction function is, as you know, they've been data dependent. And that's been a big criticism of markets because you're by nature always going to be late. And I think there's a real call now for the Fed to essentially become forward looking. I think that's the big change. In fact, Austin Goolsbee yesterday on CNBC, I don't know if you heard his interview, but he actually used the word forward looking when it comes to responding to financial stability. That is, I kind of would say that's an important word to keep in mind, that markets have been frustrated with a data dependent Fed. And so I think come September, even if it's 25, but they say that they're going to start being more forward looking, especially regarding inflation. I think that, you know, they could do 5 cuts this year.
And say that happens, then what do we get?
Well, something to keep in mind is that if the Fed is doing 5 cuts and their dot plot was 3, that's a incrementally dovish Fed. And so I think that that is indirectly going to be interpreted by markets as a Fed put back into play, like put for the economy. But now the economy is the stock market and risk assets like crypto. But there's a practical effect. You know, auto loans, small business loans, you know, which used to use LIBOR, but they don't. They use a SOFR now. Credit card debt, home equity lines of credit, adjustable rate mortgages. ARMs are becoming very popular because of the high cost of fixed rate mortgages. Those will see huge drops if the Fed cuts 1.25 percentage points. So there is a true economic catalyst. I mean, that, like, if someone says the Fed cutting doesn't gonna make a difference, I mean, this is an economy that's been crippled by high cost, and then you're taking that high cost away. That really would revive demand, you know, at a time when the consumer still has a lot of room to borrow money, actually.
Do you have any worry that any cuts by the Fed might amplify the carry trade risk that we've seen with the yen, sort of, you know, the a stronger dollar type of effect, and just like make things work, make the things that we saw on Sunday even worse?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the Fed doesn't want financial instability, but, you know, a stock market going up 20% isn't really concerning the Fed. You know, what concerns them is a misallocation of capital. And if capital is put into financial markets because no one wants to do CapEx, or nobody wants to expand a business because the Fed might crush the economy, you know, we might have to think that by cutting interest rates, the Fed is essentially allowing capital to be put back into the real economy. I don't know a lot of CEOs who've been doing CapEx, because why would they invest more at a time when the Fed's tight and is worried about inflation and could crush the economy? I mean, that's not the kind of environment that greenlights capital spending projects. So I think, believe it or not, it's actually has been an impediment to economic growth, but it also has amplified carry trade, because you're right, people seek yield when you you know, have an artificial high cost of money.
Tom, can you make the steel man the argument for that this wasn't a growth scare, that we are maybe in the beginning of a recessionary period of time, that things get more bearish from here? If you were asked to kind of steel man that case, what would you say?
Okay, so let's flip the hat. I would say, you know what, a recession, as you know, expansions don't die of old age. They get killed by the Fed, right? So did the Fed stay tight too long and it's already killed the economy? Well, that's one way you kill an expansion. The second way, of course, is you create a shock. I mean, let's like look at both, but is the economy already in a path to actually crumble? The area that's weak right now, we already know there's three areas of recession. Automobiles, auto sales is in a recession. You know, whether it's used car prices are going to run a free fall tomorrow, we get Manheim, but you know, used car prices have been tanking. And automakers raised prices with greedflation. Now there's inventory piling up. Auto delinquencies are up. That's in pretty bad shape. The second area that's in bad shape is durable goods. I mean, people aren't buying appliances, things that installment debt. I mean, it's just too expensive. You know, credit card debt is, you know, cost of credit is 25%. I mean, who's going to buy a dishwasher with that, those kind of costs? And the third is that housing activity is in a recession because it's prohibitively expensive to get a mortgage now. And home prices have gone up. It's not clear if they're going up because of tight supply or if it's, you know, for whatever reason, but it's gone up and it's hard to get money. So could those three drive a recession? Absolutely. I mean, a durables recession in housing is really sometimes where you get a recession. So is housing so far gone that that is impossible to turn around by the Fed? We'll see, right? I mean, if they're worried about inflation, they could put a death spiral in that part of the economy. There's not overinvestment anywhere else. I mean, the stock market, like let's say someone thinks it's a bubble, it's not really what causes the recession. It's that too much capital is raised in a bubble and then it's misallocated. That's what happened with the dot-com. And then, of course, there could be a shock. I mean, like what you're pointing out, is the yen carry unwind, is that a shock? I mean, that could be a shock. If oil supply is massively disrupted, that definitely could be a shock, right? I mean, oil could go either way. It's either going to go up a lot or down a lot, but that could create a shock too. And that could just, you know, and that could interrupt trading of currencies. I mean, currency stability is important too. So I think it's possible that you could have a recession, but really, like, as I talk it through, I would say the housing thing, I'm not as inclined to think it's going to lead to a recession because we know there's a lot of pent up demand. It's not like you've exhausted demand, and it's mortgage rates would drop as soon as the Fed starts cutting, especially adjustable rate. But could oil spike? You know, you have to get oil to around 250, and around 250, the debts, you know, the cost of gasoline as a percentage of household income is enough to be recessionary.
Have we ever seen it cause that? Have we ever seen a growth scare like this in the past, Tom, that would be analogous? Because, you know, like just looking at the VIX, we see, you know, 2008, 2020, and obviously a lot more happened after the initial like VIX spike, a lot of negative things, right? And it just seems weird that the market, like the whole thing feels weird. It feels weird that the market is so on edge, so fragile, like just a little blip and then boom. You know, the Japanese stock market is down 12%. And like, it feels like we're in a sort of a strange time. And it may be getting back to kind of the dot-com bubble, right? AI has been on absolute tear. That could be in, mm-hmm. in bubbly territory. But like, just in general, is there anything like this that we have seen in history that would be analogous?
Ryan, I want to just point out a couple of things. I'm not trying to oversimplify this, but because I've been following equity markets for 31 years, 32 years actually now.
That's approximately three crypto lifetimes, I would say.
Yes, that's right. I'm like, then, yeah, that means I'd have great grand crypto children.
yes.
They say bull markets take the escalator up and the elevator down. So big corrections like this are more associated with a bull market than a bear market. In fact, if you look at 08, for instance, when that market was topping, it was bleeding and bleeding. And then it was towards the end that you were having these get me out of everything declines. Whereas this S&P was essentially fell over 3 days. I mean, the correction, might be 2 weeks, but it really is just 3 days of sheer horror. And those kind of panics definitely happened. You know, in 2018, you had the tantrum around the Fed because Powell was raising rates. And, COVID created a huge decline that was quickly reversed. I mean, that was the fastest decline of 45%, I think, in history at the time, right? And as you know, the mistake people made in 2020, and we were dealing with the blowback, was everybody was like, you know what? This is the knock-on effects on the economy is just getting started, and we don't even know if, how to contain this disease and how deadly it's going to be, how you're going to fix it. But the stock market bottomed in March 2020. You know, that was 6 months before the vaccines were even out. So I think that the Fed can fix these ripples really easily, even if they just do it in September. I know it seems unusual, and it is. I mean, the stock market's been doing great. We had low volatility for 2 years, and now volatility is coming back. That's what's changed. But I think it's probably just more that this bull market is becoming a teenager,
All right, teenager, not the end of life, early in its career, not long in the tooth yet. Let's turn to crypto, Tom. So one thing I started this episode with was just the statement that you were bullish on crypto on CNBC in TradFi circles before it was cool. And I remember seeing you on CNBC talking about how Bitcoin back in 2017, how Bitcoin could reach the 100K range, you said. And this was a pretty bold statement, not just on, like TradFi media, CNBC, but particularly like at a time when Bitcoin is trading like under 10K, it might've been like 6K or something. You're calling for 100,000, right? This is way back when Bitcoin was very contrarian on Wall Street. I'm curious, what made you bullish back then? Like, what indicators did they use? Why did you hop aboard this train?
I think my background in research probably might explain a little bit of that. But in 2017, we spent a good part of that year kind of trying to understand why Bitcoin was actually rising. So, our approach historically in research is like price is the signal. So we won't look at something and say, oh, it's a bubble. We'd rather say, is something rising? And is it telling us something? And we have to understand what's happening. So we spent a good part of 2017 trying to build a model that would explain Bitcoin's price history. And then we were really shocked to find out that it was really two variables that simply explain most of Bitcoin's price movement. One was, and these are just widely known, but one was just using the idea of a network effect. So the number of wallets, and that there'd be exponential benefit. I mean, that's just a well-known effect. I mean, Metcalfe's law has been around for a long time. And the second was that transaction activity per wallet was a secondary explanatory variable. So and back then you could get pretty good data. It's not really so useful anymore. But that explained like 87% of the price rise of Bitcoin since 2010 or 2011, not for the full history. And so we modeled that forward and we said the first report we published was Bitcoin. That was in 2017. Bitcoin was 1200 at the time, that Bitcoin could reach just a simple, I think it was 30% increase in wallets per year would get you to 30% cumulative increase, 25,000 by 2022 was the initial sort of view. And I think that we were met with a lot of skepticism. The reason I wasn't too skeptical is I used to be a wireless analyst. So before Being a strategist, I'd spent 17 years covering technology stocks, first at Kidder Peabody, then Solomon Brothers. And one thing I realized back then was that traditional financial markets, equity investors especially, are generally older people. They're in their 40s and 50s. And they don't understand that the economy is driven by young people. I was 24 at the time when I started writing wireless research as a senior analyst. I was really fortunate. I got the chance to be a publishing analyst really young. And being that young, I saw how useful cell phones were. There were only 34 million cell phones in 93. And today there's 7 billion. So just imagine, people were skeptical of cell phones in 93 because they thought they were yuppie toys. But I found them, and being in 20, how useful they were for in terms of social life. And so I had seen how people who manage money already have established their lives. They're already making money on the incumbents. They don't want new technologies to be disruptive. And so that's exactly really what happens with crypto. Crypto is really very hostile to the traditional banking system. And I think that explains why there's such a negative bias towards it, even today, actually.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I kind of wonder what people thought back in 2017. It's just like as you were talking about this, but I think your analog to cell phones is right. I mean, that's another Metcalfe's law thing, right? The value of the network grows as more people have cell phones. It's no different than the number of Bitcoin addresses there are, the number of value exchanged on chain. So you're just kind of extrapolating to that. I think the other thing that tripped maybe TradFi up, but you tell me, is just they understood Metcalfe's law through internet tech stocks and that sort of thing. But this was a new asset that you couldn't buy, inside Charles Schwab, and you couldn't see necessarily track in Bloomberg. You couldn't custody it with your regular exchanges. And so it was foreign from that perspective too. What's the current temperature? So now, obviously, there's been a lot of changes from 2017 to 2024, including we have a Bitcoin ETF, we have an Ethereum ETF, we have people like Larry Fink from BlackRock talking about pivoting on Bitcoin and the virtues of tokenization and releasing their own crypto ETF products with Bitcoin and Ethereum. What's the current temperature on Wall Street? How has it changed? And what additional work is left to do? You sort of alluded to not everyone is convinced yet. What's the current environment?
Things have definitely moved a long way. But 6 years is not a lifetime in traditional financial world. The financial industry, banking, has adopted new products. I mean, think about credit default swaps. That was invented in the 90s and on spreadsheets. And that was initially just literally bets on a default. And now it turned into a bigger market than the underlying cash bond market. and so crypto is still in the earliest stages. I give you an analogy. Telecom was originally wireline and long distance, and that was a $160 billion revenue business. And wireless, even by 1999, was like $10 billion. It was only one-tenth the size, and I'd been covering it almost a decade. But once wireless got large enough in terms of number of people with cell phones, all the innovation of communications took place on mobile phones, right? Like, you don't have smart wired phones, or you don't have like browsers on your wired phone because you don't need it. You don't, like, it has no usefulness. And so all the innovation, if you think about financial products and how you change like what loyalty is or money or you tokenize assets, it's all going to take place probably on the blockchain. And so that is that crossover hasn't happened yet, because you know what? The banking industry still makes plenty of money, just like long distance companies. And it's kind of the burden is on the industry to be quite innovative in a really secure way that doesn't scam people through the innovation. It's just like you can watch a parallel right now in electrification of cars. because so many, you know, if you look at who adopts EVs, it's all young people. Hmm. Who likes ICE cars, internal combustion? It's all the same people that buy, you know, who are money managers. You know, it's all people over age 50 because they're like, you know, I like the sound of a V8 engine, or, you know, I don't want to drive a glorified golf cart. But actually, the reality is, like, the smartest cars and the most intelligent ones and the safest pretty soon are all going to be electric cars. So what that's the same battle, like Elon Musk's battle today, and he's fighting against the incumbents like GM, and is really what crypto is battling. But I think the industry hasn't done a great job of necessarily innovating yet. You know, price is still very compelling, and like the movements in price and products around trading prices, but it hasn't yet done, it hasn't really gotten to that smartphone moment yet.
Another reminder, I guess, that demographics is destiny when it comes to kind of, you know, consumer preferences, and that's in investment. Investors as consumers as well. So I'm kind of curious, Tom, what's your forecast for Bitcoin now from a price perspective?
Well, there has been some damage from the sell-off and the liquidations. And then there's been supply because of Mt. Gox and whatnot. But I think it's still, we still think risk assets are going to have a really big second half. Maybe after the election, though. So let's say August to October isn't like the time I think anyone should be that heroic. And, but if the S&P, you know, has 20% upside from here into year end, I think Bitcoin can easily get to 100,000 or more. And so I know it seems like very difficult, but it is important to keep in mind, like, Bitcoin doesn't move in a linear fashion anyways, right? It has step function gains. I mean, our team has published something from 2017, which was the rule of 10 days, if you take out, it's rule number 5, but if you take out the 10 best days of Bitcoin in any year, it actually has essentially negative returns. I mean, Bitcoin makes all of its percentage gains in a handful of days.
It's kind of a funny asset from that perspective, because it's kind of elevator up and elevator down, I guess, in the world of crypto, isn't it?
High-speed elevator. Yeah, directions.
That's right. How about Ethereum or other crypto assets? Do you have any predictions on
yeah,
this?
Yeah, I mean, I like, because I spend time with talking to Sean Farrell, who's our head of digital asset strategy. And, you know, I mean, there's really three, what he considers core crypto assets, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Solana. And for different reasons, because, you know, Ethereum was originally innovative because of the smart contract, but really its strength is now the community that supports it. And it's true with Solana. Solana, you know, has a really dedicated, rich community. And that's why you can eventually hope to see some innovations. I mean, even Bitcoin can be quite innovative. But all of that is, I think, still to come. I mean, there's a lot, but those would be the three that our team is betting on.
So I guess back to the current market that we find ourselves in. Do you have any thoughts on the election and how that might change things? You said don't be heroic from now until October, but then of course we'll have election results. And then what if it goes in the Republican direction versus the Democrat direction? Is there any difference in your mind from an investor perspective?
You know, markets really, people care so much in this election because people care about so many issues, whether it's, you know, abortion or trans rights or family values or own your own crypto. And that's why there's a lot emotionally at stake. From November 2024 to November 2025, as someone said, will either party winning make a difference for stock market returns? I don't think it's going to make a difference until then. I think it makes a huge difference on what sectors lead, because we know Trump is running on a platform of pro-Bitcoin. Which I think is very admirable. I don't even have any understanding why the U.S. should be hostile to Bitcoin. The second is that he is all for deregulating and reducing the regulatory encroachment of businesses. That's been a huge problem for small businesses and for large businesses, and it's an impediment to M&A. And the reality is that I think Trump also is more real estate friendly, so he'll try to implement policies that are protective of commercial real estate. So I think that there's a really big difference in what sectors lead. I think if Kamala wins, it's Silicon Valley friendly because she's from California. And I think that's really still a very big base of support. So I think it's, you know, strong for the fangs. But if Trump takes the White House, it's, you know, huge for Bitcoin. I mean, you know, he's talked about the importance of even using Bitcoin as a potential source of treasury holdings and reserve holdings. It's very pro small caps because all the things that would come with Trump would be a huge benefit to small cap stocks too.
Tom, this has been great. I know during these times you're in very high demand and have to jump to your next conversation with someone. Thank you so much for joining us on Bankless today. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, nice talking to you.
I also want to say, if you're interested in some of the research that Tom puts out, he's got daily videos, he's got market alerts, webinars, all sorts of materials for people who are interested in investing across the spectrum, digital assets and other assets. He's got that stuff going on at fsinsight.com. And there is, by the way, a 30-day free trial right now for anyone listening to Bankless. So there'll be a link in the show notes for that. Tom, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And as usual, got to end with this. Of course, you know, markets are risky. So is crypto. Crypto is a market. You know what that means. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.
New projects are coming online to the Mantle Layer 2 every single week. Why is this happening? Maybe it's because Mantle has been on the frontier of Layer 2 design architecture since it first started building Mantle DA, powered by technology from EigenDA. Maybe it's because users are coming onto the Mantle Layer 2 to capture some of the highest yields available in DeFi and to automatically receive the points and tokens being accrued by the $3 billion Mantle treasury in the Mantle reward station. Maybe it's because the Mantle team is one of the most helpful teams to build with, giving you grants, liquidity support, and venture partners to help bootstrap your Mantle application. Maybe it's all of these reasons all put together. So if you're a dev and you want to build on one of the best foundations in crypto, or you're a user looking to claim some ownership on Mantle's DeFi apps, click the link in the show notes to getting started with Mantle. Have you ever felt that the tools for developing decentralized applications are too restrictive and fail to leverage advancements from traditional software programming? There's a wide range of expressive building blocks beyond conventional smart contracts and Solidity development. Don't waste your time building the basics from scratch, and don't limit the potential of your vision. Cartesi provides powerful and scalable solutions for developers that supercharge app development. With a Cartesi virtual machine, you can run a full Linux OS and access decades of rich code libraries and open source tooling for building in Web3. And with Cartesi's unique rollup framework, you'll get real-world scaling and computation. No more competing for block space. So, if you're a developer looking to push the boundaries of what's possible in Web3, Cartesi is now offering up to $50,000 in grants. Head over to Cartesi's grant application page to apply today. And if you're not a developer, those with staked CTSI can take part in the governance process and vote on whether or not a proposal should be funded. Make sure you're vote ready by staking your CTSI before the votes open. Launching a token? Don't let complex legal and tax issues slow you down. Toku provides specialized support to optimize your launch and ensure that you as a founder and your team and your investors get the most tax-efficient outcomes. The Toku team understands the crypto space inside and out and will ensure your token launch is fully compliant while maximizing tax efficiency. Toku can connect you with the best attorneys if you need them to make sure that you have the best advice, and Toku can help to optimize your taxes so you pay the least possible amount of taxes while still maintaining legal compliance. With Toku's guidance, you can concentrate on building your company while Toku handles the logistics. Token launches don't have to be complicated. Talk to Toku today to get a free initial token valuation.